Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Boy, it felt in part like a referendum on Trump, but really, to me, that points to something deeper, which is a referendum on our character as a nation.
The election is over, mostly. As I record this conversation with HuffPost editor-in-chief Lydia Polgreen, some of the biggest races are unresolved, including both the Senate and gubernatorial race in Florida, which are now too close to call.
Which feels about right for how I'm feeling about the country at this moment. It's too close to call.
I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety, Gender, Power, and the Midterm Elections. And in this episode, we take stock. Lydia and I sat down to figure this all out with conservative columnist Mona Charon.
Well, I've been in a clinical depression since 2015 when Donald Trump first announced that he was running and it seemed that he was popular. So for me, this is an ongoing process.
Along with Kelly Dittmar of the Center for American Women in Politics.
I think this election was a lot about challenging who gets power, who has power, who deserves power in our political institutions, and also who doesn't and who's been marginalized from those institutions.
So our premise in this season was that there would be this unprecedented gender gap in the congressional vote like we normally see, you know, in presidential elections. And so, Kelly, did that happen?
Yeah, so the gender gap in the generic poll, the House poll, it's a little harder to measure in these House races because it really varies across states, but it was about 12 points. If you compare that to the difference between men and women voting for the winning candidate of Donald Trump, it was 11 points. So the gap itself wasn't enormously different, but it certainly was highly influential, I think, in many of these contests where you saw districts flip.
And Lydia, where does that lead us? How has this election changed the Democratic Party?
In some ways, you'd think, oh, wow, this progressive wave, really incredible. But it turns out that the big sort of Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, progressive wing of the party essentially got bupkis in the midterms, right? But what really seemed to work were candidates, particularly women of color. I think about Georgia's 6th district, where you had Newt Gingrich, who is the sort of Republican congressman, former Speaker of the House. Had that seat for 20 years. It's been in Republican hands since 1979. And Lucy McBath, who's an anti-gun activist, a woman of color whose son was killed, became an activist and ran for that seat and won and flipped it. So there I think you're seeing a candidate who's super motivated by an issue that they care about deeply, who's then able to translate that into a movement around them. Another candidate that I would highlight also in a competitive district, again, a woman of color, is Lauren Underwood, who won in the Chicago kind of exurbs. Again, real Republican stronghold. And I think that what this reflects is that There's just no one formula. I mean, there was a lot of questions about, you know, should we be running moderates? Well, you had two Senate candidates, Joe Donnelly and Claire McCaskill, who, for all intents and purposes, ran as Republicans, probably not that distinguishable from Mona Charon, you know, traditional moderate Republicans. They both lost. really, the verdict of this election for the Democratic Party is this left-wing progressive part of the party, it isn't very effective at flipping seats, right? And then the moderate Democrats don't seem to be very good at winning in deep red states. So I think that the takeaways are not simple. It's a complex map that, you know, where the road to victory is going to look very different in different places.
I think what Lydia said is absolutely right. It's a big, complex country, and it'd be foolish to try to apply one template for the whole complicated map. That much having been said, there are some big trends that were in evidence. And speaking of women, one of them is undeniable is that suburban, traditionally Republican women voters have been dropping away from the Trumpified Republican Party. And they have put seats in the hands of Democrats that would not, I think, absent the Trump effect, have been competitive. And one of them was in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., Barbara Comstock's seat, one of the first to fall. And so what that will mean for, you know, going forward for our politics is at this moment not clear, but it is certainly a noticeable trend.
Is there a story amongst conservative women that we aren't hearing?
Look, I did vote Democrat for the first time in my life because I wanted to send a message to the Republicans that they had lost me. But also because in Virginia, where I vote, the Republican nominee for Senate was absolutely detestable, this man called Corey Stewart, who has played footsie with white nationalists and racists and so forth. And that was just beyond the pale. And so I did vote Democrat for the first time, but not very comfortably, I have to say. I'm not a fan of Tim Kaine. And so there's a big middle, I think, in the country that is dissatisfied with all of the choices on offer. And I guess I'm in that basket now.
Just to jump on that, Mona, you know, my grandparents were Goldwater Republicans. My grandmother, 92 years old now, lives in Hudson, Wisconsin, lifelong Republican voter. The 2016 election was the first time that she didn't vote for the Republican nominee. She could not bring herself to vote for Hillary. She told me she voted for a third party. And so I think about her and her perspective on the current party a lot. And one of the things that I noticed that was really interesting, particularly about the Virginia race that you mentioned, but then a number of other races where the female Democrats who won had, they were either prosecutors, some of them were, you know, had been in the CIA or in the military. Mm-hmm. And these are really interesting candidates, right? Because I think that they do have a certain kind of appeal to suburban conservative-leaning women, which I think is some canny casting on the part of the Democrats in these races.
Yes.
And I think that they're enormously appealing to voters like my grandmother who, you know, feel really lost in the Republican Party right now.
Kelly, can you speak to that? I mean, you have been watching the full, your explicit lens on the election was watching all of the women who were vying for office and who was succeeding and who was failing. Did you see patterns that we should be paying attention to?
Yeah, I mean, here's the dominant pattern. Mona mentioned, you know, there's no new type of sort of conservative woman in that. Instead, people are, you know, leaving the party. There was no new type of Republican woman who won in this election. In fact, the Republican women will lose representation in Congress. So in spite of all of the conversations of the quote-unquote year of the woman, we will have fewer than 20 Republican women in the U.S. House after this election. And we have in the class of 35 new women already selected. There's a couple of races too close to call yet. Of those 35 new women in the House in next year, one is a Republican woman so far.
But there will be, all told, at least 118 women in Congress, which is a record. And so, and if they're all Democratic, what is it about these women that so excited Democratic voters?
So we, you know, say we're going to just vote for the most qualified person. Sure, but a qualification that people bring to office is their lived experiences, which are different for women, are different for women of color, are different for communities of color, are different for veterans, right? They're different for all of these reasons, and we should value that. And I think a lot of the women who were successful this year really did present themselves and their identities in a sort of full 360-degree way. They talked about their gender, their race, as a value added to their candidacy instead of a hurdle they would have to overcome to be successful.
So quickly, you guys, I also want to check in on just democracy, period. And I just want to go around the horn and see how each of you feel about that. Maybe start with you, Kelly.
I think that we are having a democratic dialogue again about who gets power, who has power, and who doesn't. And in that case, I'm sort of optimistic that we're confronting these imbalances and really looking to new voices and individuals who have been excluded to be within our political institutions and value that, not just on the basis of identity. I mean, I think when we're having these conversations about identity, we get sort of caught in this idea that all we're talking about is a demographic. We're not talking about a demographic when we talk about the importance of having a Native American woman in Congress for the first time. What we're talking about is that that woman brings a perspective and an intersectional perspective of both being a Native American person and a woman and how she experiences that. She brings that to policy debates and conversations that will be had and have been had every day in Congress without her perspective there.
I think democracy is under pressure at the moment, and it's not just in the United States, but around the developed world. You see populist nationalist movements springing up all over. So we are in the grip of something that's larger even than what's going on in America. And I'm not sure being in the midst of it that we fully understand it, but there are certain principles that I still adhere to, and unfortunately my party no longer does, my ex-party, but that I do think are instructive. So I think politics has come to play too large a role in our lives, and I think that's because the other institutions in our society have become weak. So our families are under stress. They're much weaker than they used to be. Our communities, our churches, synagogues, mosques, all of those institutions, those mediating institutions are weaker than they should be. And people are pouring too much of themselves, I think, into policy, into politics as a ratification of their identities, as a way of saying, you know, if we have X number of people in the Congress, that this will therefore make me feel more comfortable in this country as an American. And I understand that, but at the same time, I wish it didn't loom so large. I think that it has come to be our national obsession, and it's a very unhealthy one.
Does that ring true to you as well, Lydia, this idea that we're under so much stress that we've put too much into this space?
I absolutely agree with Mona on that. We spent 5 weeks last year in the fall talking to Americans in small cities. And the thing that was really striking to me is that Trump barely came up. Nobody talked about him. You know, people didn't talk about immigration or abortion or whatever the wedge hot button issue was of the moment in the national conversation. You know, people were focused on local issues. They were focused on their schools and their communities. And so I do think that, you know, that small is beautiful instinct is absolutely right. I'm also cheered by the increase in participation in our democracy, the number of people who stepped up to run for office for the first time, the number of people who registered to vote for the first time. I mean, the state of Texas normally has about 100,000 new registrations every year. And between 2016 and the midterms, they had 700,000 new registrations. And to me, that's really exciting. I think we need to get very serious about increasing voter participation. I think that charity begins at home. So I think New York, which has some of the worst voting laws in the country, needs to clean up its act. I want to make it easier for people to play their part. Vote in your school board election. Understand the issues and get out there and participate. The more that we participate and talk to each other, the better off we're going to be.
Thanks to Lydia Polgreen, Mona Charon, and Kelly Dittmar. Up next, we'll hear from a woman who is coming up on her 90s and still participating.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
The midterms are over, and let's just say it, people are tired. I am tired. It's been a long 2 years, and it's going to be a long next couple of years. So we wanted to speak with somebody who knows a little something about digging in for the long haul. Dolores Huerta. She helped found the United Farm Workers Union with Cesar Chavez, and she's spent decades fighting for racial justice and the rights of workers. Dolores is 88 years old now, and as the mother of 11 children, she is keenly aware of the balancing act that's required of women in public life. Most recently, she was involved in organizing the Women's March in 2017. So we asked her to sit down with one of her daughters, Juana, to talk about a life of activism and family and sacrifice. We produced this conversation in partnership with Latino USA. Juana kicks it off.
When you started organizing, were you working with men and women, or was it mostly male-dominated?
It was, I guess, kind of equal with men and women. Of course, when I started working with United Farm Workers, there were many women that were in the fields, but not that many women in terms of leadership.
You grew up in the 40s and the 50s, and you were of the same generation as my father, Richard Chavez. You were both activists, but in my recollection, there was some tension in the house. For instance, one time I remember there was an argument between the both of you because it was getting pretty late and he wanted us to do the dishes and we had an important homework assignment to complete. And so you were defending our right to do our homework rather than do the dishes. And I remember that argument. How did you deal with that?
Well, we had many, many arguments. The dishes were a big factor because he somehow felt that men and my son Rick shouldn't have to do the dishes. And, you know, I felt just the opposite. I felt they had to also chip in with the housework, you know, because he was a first-generation Mexican-American. My family grew up very, very differently because we had been here for generations in the United States. And so he thought girls should be married off as soon as they were 16, 17 years old. So we had these huge, huge arguments and fights.
It was challenging because you want the acceptance of your mother and your father. So it was sometimes challenging for me personally to balance that, to want to show that I was strong, independent, and a feminist, and I wanted to please you. And at the same time, I didn't want to disappoint my father. So trying to show him, like, look, I know how to cook. Look, I know how to clean. You know, so don't think I'm a total failure as a woman. But inside, I always felt, okay, for my mother, I'm being who I really want to be and who I plan to be. And for my father, I'm doing it for him. Do you remember making a conscious choice to have children, and what was that thought process like for you?
Well, I always loved children, and I guess that's why I had so many of them. And I know that there's been a lot of criticisms by people say, well, yeah, you love children so much, but you sure didn't do a very good job of taking care of them, because in my work, I had relatives helping me care for my children. I had friends. I had, you know, sometimes people that I barely met helping me take care of my children, but they all survived.
But our life at school was challenging. We were discriminated against. We were looked down on for our poverty, for our skin color, for the beliefs and ideals that our family upheld. There was an incident that happened in high school, and I've told the story often. At the time, I felt it was a lesson in humiliation. But as an adult reflecting upon it, I realized it was a lesson in materialism, in pride.
I guess the background of this story is that when we worked with United Farm Workers, we didn't get wages. Most of our clothes for the kids came from donations. And so obviously they did not have the best or the richest clothes to wear.
We also, we got food stamps.
Yeah, food stamps.
And I remember that in the store, like the tellers, like they would, you know, shame us. You felt like shame for using food stamps.
And then we had these old cars that we used to drive, these old Valiants. And so one day when I was taking the kids to school, they wanted me to drop them off a couple of blocks away from the school because they were embarrassed to be seen in this old beat up Valiant that I was driving them in. But what I did is I took them right in front of the school and honked the horn and dropped them off. And they were very upset with me.
It was terribly embarrassing. We were just hoping you wouldn't force us out and keep driving, but you, of course, made us get out and go to school. And the front of the school was where all the popular kids would hang out in the morning before school with all of their latest fashions. And so it was very embarrassing. Now it's funny, but at the time it was pretty devastating. I have some resentment, or that I've held a grudge for many years against the leadership of the United Farm Workers. And that's, you know, just a personal feeling that I've had that you have not gotten enough credit, or that they don't still give you enough credit.
Well, number one, when you do the kind of justice work that we do, you don't do it to get credit in the first place. I mean, you do it to help other people. In the work that I've been blessed to be engaged in, there have been thousands of people that have made it happen. When you think of the 17 million people that didn't buy grapes and the hundreds of farm workers that went to jail and five of our farm workers that were murdered and just trying to get the basic human rights for farm workers, the right to have a union, and people don't know their names. I have been so blessed and been recognized at the highest levels of, you know, with the getting the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Obama, being the first Latina in the National Women's Hall of Fame. So, I mean, I feel that I have been more than recognized. But I think that women often, that we are shy of being recognized. And so I just want to say to all the women out there, when you need to take credit for the work that you do, just channel Oprah. And, you know, yes, we need to be humble, but we also need to be proud.
I remember I was in my early 30s, and my partner at the time and I spoke to you. We announced to the family that we were planning on starting a family. And I remember saying to you, hey, you know, my partner and I are... We had to plan it because obviously as two women, we could not conceive a child together. So, you know, we mentioned to you and other family members that were there that we were going to start planning our family. And I remember kind of your just knee-jerk reaction was like, well why would you want to do that? Once you have kids, your life is over or something like that. And we, you know, were sitting there with a couple of your children. So it was like, we all looked at you like, what? What are you talking? You know, so.
Well, when I say that... Once you have children, your life is very different because you have to make a commitment to those children and you have to be responsible. And maybe once they're adults, you think, well, I don't really have to be responsible for what happens to them anymore, but it's still there. You have to worry about them, about their love life, their finances, or, you know, if they're ill or whatever. It impacts on a parent a lot.
I'm certainly not an activist on the level that you are, Mom. I mean, as you know, my plan to have children did not pan out. But I still find it challenging. I don't have children, and I still, you know, find it challenging to be an activist. I think that you're the gold standard and the bar that I'm trying to reach, and I always feel like I fall short of that. You know, for young women today, for activists who might ask you about the subject of having children, and what advice would you give to the young women who are activists and want to have children or do have children?
Number one, I think everybody needs to be an activist in one way or the other. And I know sometimes it's hard because we all have a lot of work in our personal lives and in our work lives, but we need to take a few hours of our life to become activists, a few hours a week, whether it's to do phone banking, canvassing, to get involved in some environmental work, whatever it may be, we need to do that. And never be ashamed of being an activist. Be proud of it, even when people make fun of you.
Thank you, Mom, for giving me this time today.
And maybe we could say it together.
Sí se puede!
That was Dolores Huerta and her daughter, Juana Chavez. Their conversation was produced by Sophia Paliza Carr of Latino USA. And you can hear a longer version of it on the Latino USA podcast. And coming up, we conclude this season by, yeah, you guessed it, thinking about 2020. And the path to power for women candidates.
There are traditional power structures that really do not want to release that grip on power, and they don't want to see the Me Too movement have the lasting impact that it will have. They don't want to see justice being done. They don't want oversight and accountability. They don't want change. They don't want to change the status quo. They like it the way it is.
The past and possible future of Kirsten Gillibrand. That's next on the United States of Anxiety. The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios and the newsroom of WNYC. This episode was reported and produced by Jessica Miller and Sophia Paliza Carr at Latino USA. And hey, Sophia, we miss you. It was edited by Kari Pitkin and Karen Froman, who is also our executive producer. Casey Means is our technical director. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Attleboro Brass Band. Michelle Harris has been our fact checker throughout this season. Allison Light is our intern. Andy Lancet is our archivist. Our team also includes Amanda Aronchik, Christopher Johnson, Melinda Siri-Wardana, Courtney Stein, Christopher Worth, and Vera Lynn Williams. Jim Schachter is vice president of news for WNYC, and I'm Kai Wright. Thanks for listening. The United States of Anxiety is supported in part by the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Additional support for WNYC's election coverage is provided by Emerson Collective, the New York Community Trust, and New York Public Radio trustee Dr. Mary White. This report is produced with support from Chasing the Dream, a public media initiative from WNET reporting on poverty, jobs, and economic opportunity in America.